Blog Talk Radio.
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother Harold Muhammad, soldier, scientist, scholar. Blog Talk Radio's finest, not so mad science, on Black Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, and as always, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. Just because Barry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. Before we get into the facts about tonight's program, which I've titled COVID-19, fact versus fiction. With respect to the vaccine, we're going to have a brief, and I do mean brief, moment of music while we get things all squared up. Because we're dealing with subject matter that is most controversial, dangerous, and ultimately scary. So, with that said, we're going to have a small, and I mean small, bit of music from Stevie Wonder, Black Hole.
Of love and fear of hate, a rushing wind that's asked to wait for the promises of rain. A pearl of wisdom entrapped by poverty. She gives love with purity, filling minds with hopeful schemes to build worlds enhanced by peace. Draped in sparkling morning dew, she expresses life anew from the earth beneath her feet. She is a flower that grows of ability, femininity. Black orchid, black orchid, why does it make you begin? When they know in time you'll find your truth before your cycle ends. Father star, how beauty speaks of what we are, and a freedom makes us free. From now is in eternity, infinite to all that see, and her dreams have been achieved. Time. her name, for the world to know her fame. Black orchid, black orchid, why did they criticize when they knew your love for Captain Bell and consecrated?
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome back to this edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Pool Radio Network. If my voice sounds a little weak, and you don't hear as much vigor from me as you all are accustomed to hearing, just know that I'm in the fight to push through. I'm not feeling very well, but this is a subject matter that is inherently important to me, as well as being life-threatening and important to you as well. And I have a duty and an obligation to share news, particularly this news. Just recently, The Defender, a children's health defense blog, released an article with regard to the facts concerning the CDC and Big Pharma and the vaccines. And it was written by Megan Redshaw. So let's get into it. It is titled, Scientists Challenge Health Officials on Vaccinating People Who Already Had COVID. The scientists have issued a warning vaccinating people who already had COVID could potentially cause harm or even death. Since the first COVID-19 vaccine received emergency use authorization in the U.S., some physicians and scientists have challenged recommendations by the U.S. Health Agency that people who already had COVID and as a result acquired a natural immunity still get the vaccine. Some experts say the science to support vaccinating those fine with COVID doesn't exist, and there is a potential risk of harm, including death, in vaccinating those who already had the disease or were recently infected. In December of 2020, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, known as the CDC, their advisory committee on immunization practices, issued a report authored by 15 scientists that falsely claimed a Pfizer study proved the vaccine was highly effective or showed consistent efficacy, high efficacy, for people who already had coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. Award-winning scientist and congressman Thomas Matthews, who I mistakenly believe was an epidemiologist, but in fact, he's a board-certified engineer who graduated from MIT, which means he understands numbers. And it is the goal of every engineer to look for the balances in the numbers to create a structure, something for things to stand on. Well, he called out the CDC when he found that the vaccine studies showed no benefit to people who had the coronavirus and that getting the vaccinated didn't change their odds of getting reinfected. the CDC claims the COVID vaccine would save your life or save you from suffering if you already had that virus and recovered, which has not been demonstrated in either the Pfizer or the Moderna trials, according to NASA, which he said in an interview with Full Measure. Now, Full Measure is a Sunday morning investigative news program hosted by Cheryl Atkinson. In their investigation, they found that the facts say something different. Instead of fixing it, they propose repeating it. Let me step back. Massey contacted the official at the CDC about the misinformation. They acknowledged it was false. But instead of correcting it, they tried to rephrase their mistake. Massey and other scientists said the new wording still wrongly implies vaccines work in people who previously had COVID. And instead of fixing it, they propose repeating it and just phrasing their mistake differently. So at that point right now, I consider it a lie. I think the CDC is lying about the efficacy of the vaccine based on the Pfizer trials for those who have already had the coronavirus, Mr. Massey said. The CDC recommends people get vaccinated even if they've already had COVID, as experts do not know how long you are protected from getting sick again after recovery from COVID. And it is possible, although rare, that you could be infected with the virus that causes COVID again. On February 23rd of this year, Francis Collins, the director of the National Institute of Health, published a blog post stating that people who had COVID still needed the vaccine, while referencing a study that suggested they didn't. Citing a pre-printed publishing on MedRxiv, Collins wrote that the immune response for the first vaccine dose in a person who already had COVID is equal to, or in some cases better, than the response to the second dose in a person who hasn't had COVID. He said the result raises the possibility that one dose might be enough for someone who's been infected with the SARS-CoV-2 and already generated antibodies against the virus. Now, I want to toss my own question in. If I've already had the virus and my body has generated antibodies against the virus, why would I need a vaccine to give me protection against something that my body has already protected me against? Just a question for us to look at. Now, let's continue. Yet Collins made the case that people who have already had COVID would have a robust antibody response when later exposed to the virus. Whether that's through natural exposure or via the spike protein from a COVID vaccine. Now, to better understand immune memory of SARS-CoV-2, researchers led by Drs. Daniela Weisskopf, Alessandro Secchi, and Shane Crocky from the Jola Institute of Immunology analyzed immune cells and antibodies for nearly 200 people who had been exposed to the COVID and recovered. The result, published in Science magazine, killed the immune system of more than 95% of people who recovered from COVID had durable memories of the virus up to 8 months after infection. Now, what does that mean to us? Durable memories of the virus. Here's what that means. That means your body has developed an immune defense system that protects you. Now, the word they use here is a robust protection. Okay. Previous studies showed that natural infection inducing a strong response, but this study showed that response lasted, according to Weisskopf. Another study in Nature magazine assessed the lasting immunogenic effect of T-cell reactivity to SARS and SARS-2. Data showed that the natural immunity was very, again, hear that word, robust, and likely more robust than any immunity derived from a vaccine. Uh-oh, starting to get to the nitty-gritty now. It has been stated that there is an increased risk of vaccine injury in those with previous infections. Okay, let's question that. On March 19th of this year, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, issued an emergency authorization for a new test to detect COVID infection, one that stands apart from the hundreds already authorized. Report STAT. Now, for those of you who do not know what STAT is, I'm going to tell it right now. This name will be called, make sure I get it right. There we go. STAT is a reporting agency for the Frontier Health and Medicine Development. It's a media company that focuses on finding and telling compelling stories about health, medicine, and scientific discovery, which means a lot of doctors, a lot of scientists report their findings in STAT because it has a broad readership amongst scientists and other medical professionals. Okay, so let's continue. Developed by a Seattle-based Adaptive Biotechnology in partnership with Microsoft, the new test called T-Detect COVID looked for signals of past infections in the body's adaptive immune system, specifically the T cells that help the body remember what its viral enemies look like. Adaptive approach involves mapping antigens to their matching receptors on the surface of T cells, which would help scientists unlock information to help diagnose past COVID infection. Dr. Dara Uda, urgent and immediate care physician at the Westchester Medical Group, received the COVID vaccine a year after having the disease and had a very strong immune response, very similar to what she experienced while having COVID. In an opinion piece published by The Hill, a political magazine produced in Washington, D.C., Udo explained that infection from any organism, including COVID, activates several different arms of the immune system. Some in more robust ways than others. And that this underlying activation due to infections or exposure combined with a vaccination could lead to overstimulation of the immune response. Now here's what that means. That means if your immune system is overly active, it then becomes counterproductive to attacking a virus. The immune system begins to attack itself. There are those people whose immune system is so active. This is what a cancer does. It's the body chemically eating itself. Udom, Dr. Udom, thought this might explain the symptoms she had, as well as her frontline colleagues who had high rates of COVID antibodies, known as several prevalent prior to becoming vaccinated. For high-risk, vulnerable groups, emerging data suggests that several prevalence of COVID-19 infection is likely higher than tested and reported. Therefore, a natural question arises of whether there may be a smarter way to administer the vaccine in high seroprevalent groups, Dr. Udom wrote. Dr. Udom called for an international, well-planned approach to avoid eliciting adverse immune responses in those who had COVID and subsequently get vaccinated. Dr. Udom suggested a person already COVID primed may be better off with a one dose rather than a two dose vaccine, or that the vaccine administered should be dependent on whether the person already had COVID. For example, someone who is COVID naive might do better with a vaccine like Pfizer or Moderna, while the COVID-primed person might need a less robust immune response from the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In order to implement this protocol, rigorous, effective, and efficient antibody-free screening tools to identify these individuals would be required, according to Dr. Udom. Dr. Human Norsham, an accomplished surgeon, patient safety advocate, and staunch supporter of the new COVID vaccine, has written several letters to the FDA urging the agency to require free screening for COVID-2 viral proteins in order to reduce COVID vaccine injury and death. According to Dr. Norsham, or Lee Cavan, it is scientifically established that a person who is naturally infected by a virus, antigens from the virus persist in the body for a long time after viral replication has stopped and clinical signs of infection have resolved. When a vaccine reactivates, an immune response in a recently infected person, the tissues harboring the persisting viral antigen are targeted, inflamed, and damaged by the immune response. Quote, in the case of the SARS-CoV-2, we know that the virus naturally infects the heart, the inner lining of blood vessels, the lungs, in the brain, sustained Dr. Norton, who is likely, the Viva likely to be some of the critical organs that will contain persistent viral antigen in the recently infected, and following reactivation of the immune system by a vaccine, these tissues can be expected to be targeted and damaged. Pauline Kelly is an associate professor of infectious diseases at Emory University, and the principal investigator for the Moderna and Novavax Phase 3 vaccine clinical trials in Atlanta. In an interview with the Huffington Post, Kelly said there has been reported cases in which those who previously had the virus endured harsher side effects than after they received the vaccine. Anecdotally, it does appear that people who have had the COVID-19 before their vaccine do tend to have more long durations of symptoms, Dr. Kelly added. Bring additional scientific data to really support this. In a public submission to the FDA, J. Patrick Whalen, MD, PhD, expressed similar concerns that COVID vaccines aimed at creating immunity against the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein could have the potential to cause microvascular injury to the brain, the heart, liver, and kidney in a way that does not currently appear to be assessed in safety trials of these potential drugs. Based on several studies, Dr. Whalen said, it appears that the viral spike protein in the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine is also one of the key agents causing damage to distant organs that may include the brain, the heart, the lungs, and kidneys. Before any of these vaccines are approved for widespread use in humans, it is important to assess in vaccinated subjects the effects of vaccinations on the heart, wrote Dr. Miller. As important as it is to quickly arrest the spread of the virus by immunizing the population, it would be vastly worse if hundreds of millions of people were to suffer long-lasting or even permanent damage to their brain or heart microvasculature as a result of failing to appreciate in the short term an unintended effect of the full-length spike protein-based vaccines on other organs. At the very minimum, Dr. Norcad was saying in a letter to the FDA officials, Pfizer, and I'm quoting them now, Pfizer and Moderna should institute clear recommendations to clinicians that may delay immunization in any recently convalescent patients, as well as any known symptomatic or asymptomatic carriers, and to actively screen as many patients with high cardiovascular risk as is reasonably possible in order to detect the presence of the SARS-CoV-2 prior to vaccination. On March 19th of this year, 32-year-old Benjamin Goodman died after receiving a Johnson & Johnson experimental COVID vaccine. According to a Facebook post by his stepmother, Goodman knew his family's difficult history with vaccines. He got vaccinated at a pop-up vaccine site at a local Walgreens because people were pushing the travel pass. Goodman felt ill, experienced a headache, woke up with a fever and chills at 1 a.m., went into cardiac arrest at 4 a.m., and was declared dead 2 hours later. Like many others, Goodman had not been tested to see if he had previously had COVID or was recently infected. Northhaven, Dr. Northhaven, sent a third communication to the FDA warning that deaths like Mr. Goodman could have been prevented and that there will be more deaths unless people are screened before being vaccinated. As a defender reported earlier this month, Dr. Northhaven believes that a screen before vaccine campaign could save millions from vaccine injury. We are deploying this defensive weapon, the COVID vaccine, widely, indiscriminately, in the midst of a pandemic outbreak, while many are the recently infected. It is my professional opinion, as an immunologist and physician, that this indiscriminate vaccination is a clear and present danger to a subset of the already infected. End quote from Dr. Norcan, as he spoke to the defense. I don't think anything else needs to be said after this. So I'm going to leave it alone. We're going to have a short program tonight, because I need you all to gestate on your 4 months. If you've already been exposed to COVID, do not take the vaccine. If you already contracted COVID, do not take the vaccine. You don't need it. If you're going to take the vaccine, which I do not recommend, get screened first to see if you have already had or been exposed to the COVID, because your body may have already developed its own defense, because the vaccine may make you worse, if not kill you. This is not some mad science, but your hope for the Harold Muhammad here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, as always, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. We're going to play an old program about the historical context of the so-called Spanish flu. I'm playing this because the response to COVID, we are seeing parallels in the dangerous practices of the U.S. government that they use. Spanish flu, which is incorrectly named Spanish flu. It should be called the American flu.
An estimated 500 million people infected, between 50 and 100 million dead. A world torn apart by war and by a strange, deadly new disease. It swept across the world, leaving nowhere untouched. It was so deadly, rumors spread through the streets that the Black Death had returned. This was the Spanish flu of 1918, the deadliest pandemic of the 20th century. Epidemics have infected societies throughout history. Usually epidemics come and go, but some truly stand out for their viciousness. In recent history, there has been no pandemic more devastating than the flu of 1918, sometimes called the Spanish flu or swine flu. It killed about 675,000 in the United States alone. The outbreak came in the midst of World War I, and the flu would actually kill more troops than combat. The flu of 1918 was so deadly it killed more Americans than World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. Yet Spanish flu was horrifying for even more reasons. It was very contagious, and it killed extremely quickly, sometimes in as few as 12 hours. It killed people in the prime of their lives, with the most victims being young, healthy people aged 20 to 40. Additionally, it killed some of its victims in bizarre, brutal ways, completely unlike a typical flu virus. Some symptoms actually closely resembled the plagues, which killed millions in the Middle Ages. But scientists have analyzed the pathogen's genome and verified it was not Black Death, with killed millions in 1918. It was just the flu. This video will cover how the flu began and how it spread across the world, the bizarre symptoms that made it so deadly, and how the flu pushed society to the very brink of collapse. If the epidemic continues its mathematical rate of acceleration, civilization could easily disappear from the face of the earth within a few weeks. Victor Vaughn, Surgeon General of the Army, October 1918. No one can be absolutely sure where the pandemic originated, but there are several theories. In northern France, there was an outbreak of a flu-like disease at a British military base in 1917. The base was located in a swampy area with lots of waterfowl and pigs. New flu epidemics often arise when people have close contact with sick birds or pigs. There was a separate outbreak of respiratory disease among soldiers from Southeast Asia who fought in World War I from 1916 to 1918. Most flus start in Southeast Asia, and some historians argue the soldier may have brought a new virus to Europe. But historian John Barry makes the case in his fascinating book, The Great Influenza, that the flu may have originated on a farm in rural Kansas by jumping from infected pigs to humans. Indeed, the first officially recognized cases of the Spanish flu emerged at a military base in Kansas. The U.S. had just entered World War I, and training and industry had ramped up at a rapid pace as the war machine fired up. But in rural Haskell County, Kansas, a war of another type was quietly beginning. Haskell County was in the grip of a deadly outbreak of what seemed to be a mysterious new disease. People in the community, farmers mostly, may have caught the new disease when a pathogen from sick pigs jumped species and began infecting humans. The new virus, the swine flu, was shockingly contagious and extremely deadly. A local doctor was terrified by the death toll of the new virus and contacted the U.S. Public Health Service for advice. His concern was noted, but nothing else was done. After all, it was a tiny rural backwater. How could it spread far in such a sparsely populated area? Slowly the virus began to die down as it ran out of new people to infect. Perhaps it would have stopped there had the times been different, but 1918 was the perfect breeding ground for a worldwide pandemic. In early 1918, every military base was teeming with young men training for war. The military hurried to build new barracks, hospitals, training areas, and facilities to support the influx of hundreds of thousands of men. Some of these men were volunteers, and some had been drafted. The strange new disease was just dying down in Haskell County when a few young men left there, headed to Camp Funston, Kansas, for training. Camp Funston, located at modern-day Fort Riley, was already over capacity, with 56,000 young men training for war. There hadn't been time to build enough barracks for all of them. It was the coldest winter on record east of the Rockies, yet many men were sleeping in tents without any heat and only thin blankets. In an effort to keep them all warm, the commander ordered all the men to move into barracks, violating the health and safety rules that dictated how much space each soldier should have. Inside the barracks, men huddled around stoves trying to keep warm. The men from Haskell County must have crowded in close too, even as they began to cough and sneeze. That's all it took. In the overcrowded barracks, the flu spread rapidly. It only took 6 days for the outbreak to begin. The men from Haskell County arrived on February 28th. Less than 1 week later, men began flooding into sick call. Within just a few weeks, the flu swept across the base, sickening thousands and killing between 38 and 50. It was a high death rate for the flu, but it was nothing compared to what was coming next. The virus was about to mutate and become much, much worse. Flu viruses are constantly mutating, and sometimes there will be a really big shift, or a virus that usually affects only animals mutates so it can infect people too. When that happens, it can be very deadly. The flu comes in waves. That's why we have a flu season. Although it may seem like a bad flu is done, the flu can hide for a while, or go infect people in a different part of the world, and then return even worse. In the case of the 1918 flu, three waves of flu devastated the world. The first wave wasn't too bad, but the second and third waves were extremely dangerous. The outbreak at Camp Funston came just at the end of the flu season in the United States, so the first wave infected a lot of people, but then faded away. The military wasn't worried. They were grappling with a far more deadly outbreak of measles at the time. The flu virus seemed to fade away, but really, it just went abroad to take on a world at war. It stalked into camp when the day was damp and chilly and cold, with a hand that was clammy and bony and bold, and its breath was icy and moldy and dank, and it killed so speedy and gloatingly greedy that it took away men from each company rank. The flu, Private Josh Lee, 1919. Nearly all the ships carrying American troops to war arrived at the port in Brest, France. In April of 1918, just as the flu outbreak was dying down at Camp Funston, an epidemic began in Brest and slowly began spreading throughout northern France. Despite the illness spreading in the city, more and more troops poured in. Healthy men would land, become infected, and then ship out to new duty stations and to the front line, carrying the disease through every small town and hamlet through which the armies traveled. The flu tore across France and followed the front lines into Belgium and the Netherlands. It jumped across the lines of war and began infecting the German army, actually affecting the outcomes of battle since so many troops were too sick to fight. It jumped from the German army to the German people. By May, it had reached Italy, where it crossed the Mediterranean and surged into North Africa. It also arrived in England by May, riding back on boats with troops heading home. Infection and death rates began to skyrocket in Spain and Portugal. The flu gained its name, the Spanish flu, from the early infection and high mortality rate in Spain, where reported 8 million died in May. Spain was neutral in World War I, and as a result, it was one of the only countries that was reporting the news without strict government censorship. Most countries didn't want to reveal to their enemies that they were battling an epidemic, and didn't want to affect their people's morale. So the governments pressured the media to hide and downplay the severity of the virus. However, in neutral Spain, the press was free to report the news accurately. Newspaper headlines in Spain screamed of an epidemic that was killing millions, while other countries only whispered of the flu. The world believed the flu was worse than Spain, when in actuality, Spain was the only one talking about it at first. The flu continued spreading beyond Western Europe. By July, it had jumped to Scandinavia and Greece. The same month, the flu crept its way into a tense Russia, where the Tsar and his family had just been executed, and the Bolsheviks were battling with other factions to see who would control the future of Russia. A boat filled with six sailors arrived in Mumbai, India at the end of May. First, a few dock workers reported sick. Then workers at the next docks became ill. And then men at the nearby warehouses got sick, and so on, into the city. Ships left those same infested docks and spread to other ports in Asia. Sick people boarded trains in Mumbai and spread the disease like wildfire along the railroad lines up into the subcontinent and continental Asia. The flu showed up in China around the same time, spreading inland from a dock in Shanghai. By June, it had arrived in Singapore, a world trade hub where the flu infected the dock workers and spread to the local population. From the bustling dock, sailors carried the flu south into Indonesia and north into Malaysia and Thailand, where it continued to spread. By July, it had reached sub-Saharan Africa, with infected sailors who arrived at the ports. It entered West Africa from ships arriving in Freetown, Sierra Leone. It infected Eastern Africa via the port in Mombasa, Kenya. Ships arriving into Cape Town set the virus loose in South Africa. From these ports, influenza ripped its way across the continent, devastating the population. By July, it had also reached Peru and begun spreading across South America. By August, it had returned to North America. By October, it had reached New Zealand and Japan. By November, a lethal outbreak was surging across Colombia, Argentina, Uruguay, and Chile. Despite quarantines on ships entering port, dock restrictions, and a concerted effort at containment, it finally spread into Australia by 1919. In less than a year, the deadly flu had surged around the world. The flu was able to spread so efficiently for many reasons, including the movement of vast companies of troops around the world, and the conditions those troops were living in. World War I was desperately brutal, and trench warfare made for horrific living conditions and for the perfect breeding ground for disease. Men lived out in the open, with no protection from the freezing winter, the pounding rain, or the sweltering sun. Troops at the front lines lived in filthy trenches for months at a time, where they had to eat, sleep, and answer all the calls of nature within close contact with each other. When it rained, the trenches filled up with water that became rank and foul as it had nowhere to drain. Men's feet rotted in their boots, a condition called trench foot. Dead bodies lay decomposing in no man's land between the two armies. When it rained, water would wash excrement, decomposing body parts and filth down into the trenches where the men lived. Constant bombing churned up the dirt and turned the ground into a sloppy swamp. The mud became so bad that in some places it was like quicksand. Planks were laid down for the men to walk on. There were cases of horses, pack mules, and even soldiers slipping off the walkways and drowning in the mud before they could struggle out of their heavy gear. By the end of the war, over 9 million combatants and 7 million civilians would die in the war. Thus, it's not surprising that when a virulent new virus arrived, it became an even more deadly foe than the enemy soldiers. At some point in the summer of 1918, the flu mutated to become more deadly. It gave some people the normal symptoms of fever, chills, nausea, aches, and diarrhea, and many got sick then recovered like a normal flu. Some were sick longer or died after catching a secondary infection, such as pneumonia. However, many people became violently ill with strange symptoms. In fact, in the July 1918 edition of the medical journal The Lancet, doctors argued that this strange epidemic couldn't be the flu because the symptoms didn't fit. Italian doctors argued the same. In some people, Spanish flu caused fevers that were so high people hallucinated. Some writhed in agonized muscle pain so bad that doctors thought they had dengue, also called breakbone fever. It made some people temporarily or even permanently blind, deaf, or paralyzed. Some lost the ability to smell. Some had strong vertigo and would fall over if they tried to walk. Extreme ear infections developed very quickly, going from the first pain to the eardrums rupturing within only a few hours. Some had terrible headaches and double vision. Severe mucus excretions and inflammation made it hard for victims to breathe. Some people coughed so hard they tore their abdominal muscles. Doctors doing autopsies saw lungs so damaged that they resembled those of people who died from poisonous gas in the war. Some people developed a symptom most physicians had never seen before. Tiny puffs of air would leak out from tears in the lungs and get trapped beneath the skin, puffing up in little pockets all over their bodies. When they moved, the pockets would crackle like a bowl of Rice Krispies, according to one nurse. Some people developed hemorrhagic fever, which, like Ebola, causes its victims to bleed. An Army report described the flu as a rapidly escalating infection and lungs choked with blood, fatal in from 24 to 48 hours. Some people bled from their nose, their ears, and their eyes. Some people with the 1918 flu became so oxygen-starved they began to turn blue or even looked black, a condition called cyanosis. People reportedly turned so dark that it was difficult to distinguish white people from people of color. For this reason, the flu picked up the nickname the Blue Death, and many wondered if the Black Death had returned. When people began turning blue, doctors knew they wouldn't survive more than a few hours. The flu was also terrifying because it could kill so quickly. Many victims died within a day or two, or even hours of showing their first symptoms. According to a story recounted in the book The Great Influenza, a man in Cape Town, South Africa, boarded a streetcar just as a conductor died. During the 3-mile ride to his house, 6 more people on the streetcar died. When the driver died, he got off the streetcar and walked home. We've had a number of cases where people were perfectly healthy and died within 12 hours. Charles Edward Winslow, epidemiologist and professor at Yale University. In late summer of 1918, the flu virus returned to America, but this time it was far more deadly. In August, a ship full of sick people arrived in New York City from Europe. 4 men had already died at sea, and 200 more people on the ship were sick. Many were taken to hospitals, but they weren't quarantined. and the following week, several more ships full of sick people arrived. The same was happening in other deep water ports, like Boston, Philadelphia, and New Orleans. At the same time, as the virus was arriving and spreading in ports, ships left those same ports headed for Canada, Central America, the Caribbean, and South America, carrying infected people. In early September, there was an outbreak at Navy Pier in Boston. The pier was quarantined, but officers still moved between bases. An officer was probably responsible for carrying the flu to nearby Camp Devens. At first, just a few men reported sick, and then within only a few days, an epidemic broke out. By mid-September, thousands of men were sick, in many cases violently so. Of those who were sick, 75% were so ill they had to be hospitalized. The sheer number of patients overwhelmed the medical staff at the military hospital. The hospital had been designed to treat a maximum of 1,200 troops at one time, yet more than 6,000 patients were crammed in. Cots were stuffed into every available space, in hallways and offices, even on outdoor porches. The doctors and nurses fell ill. There were simply not enough healthy people to care for the thousands of sick people. So many died that they couldn't all fit in the hospital morgue. The dead were stacked up one on top of another, like firewood in the hallway outside the morgue. Every day they were carted away, and every day the hall filled up again. The Army medical officers issued an order that no men should be sent to or shipped out of Camp Devens. However, that's not what happened. A group of officers left Camp Devens, headed to Camp Grant in Illinois. Despite the rules against it, the chief officer there had authorized overcrowding due to a shortage in barracks, once again giving the ideal environment for the disease to spread. Shortly after arriving, the officers from Camp Devens became sick. The men were quarantined, but it was already too late. Within 2 days of the first cases, the flu was widespread throughout the camp. Within 4 days of the first case, men started dying. Within 5 days, doctors and nurses became sick and started dying. By 6 days, there were 4,000 men admitted to the hospital, and they converted 10 barracks into temporary hospitals. By 7 days, they were running out of medicine, disinfectant, and other medical supplies. By 9 days, they converted 9 more barracks to service hospitals, bringing the number up to 20. They didn't have enough beds, sheets, or ambulances to carry all the infirm. When they ran out of beds, soldiers were ordered to stuff straw into sacks to use as mattresses for the sick. They still didn't have enough. They tried to make enough face cloths to cover people's mouths to fight the spread of germs, but they ran out of cloth. The Red Cross set up a station to notify relatives that their loved ones were dying or dead. Now relatives poured into the midst of a deadly epidemic. Healthy relatives were escorted by coughing service members to identify dead bodies in the morgue. They crowded into the overfilled hospitals to visit ill loved ones. Desperate parents and wives tried to bribe nurses and orderlies to give special care to their soldier. It became such a problem that the head officer issued a warning about accepting bribes. Those relatives would leave the camp and carry the infection out into the civilian community, into local towns, onto cross-country trains, and ultimately back to their own hometowns. Civilian health officials called for an emergency quarantine of Camp Grant, but the virus was already out. 4 days after the first reported case, a trainload of troops had left Camp Grant to go cross-country to Camp Hancock near Augusta, Georgia. For the journey of almost 1,000 miles, the men were packed tightly into train cars with poor ventilation. In the tight quarters, men coughed, became feverish, and began bleeding from their eyes and ears. They infected each other swiftly, and the virus swept along the train. The train stopped repeatedly along the journey to refuel, and the men who could still walk got off the train to get a break from the hacking coughs of the sick and delirious men. There they interacted with railroad workers and curious locals who had come to see the troops. They infected town after town for almost 1,000 miles. When they finally arrived in Georgia, 2,000 of the 3,000 men were so sick they needed to be hospitalized immediately. They started a new outbreak at Camp Hancock. Historians don't know how many of the men from the train died, but one report from Fort Leonard Wood claims 10%. Yet when hundreds began dying, the medical staff at the hospital stopped keeping careful records. They were just too overwhelmed by all the dead. One robust person showed the first symptoms at 4 o'clock p.m. and died by 10 o'clock a.m. The Journal of the American Medical Association. The same thing would happen at bases across America. At Camp Custer in Michigan, 2,800 troops reported sick in a single day. At the same time, hundreds of thousands of troops were still shipping out to Europe. By this point, the government knew how dangerous the flu was, so they had tried to contain the virus on ships. Visibly sick men were not allowed on the ships, but this didn't make much difference in the end. The flu virus incubates for a few days before any signs of infection are visible. On board the ships, the men were locked into their bunk rooms for most of the voyage across the sea, and armed military police enforced the segregation. On most ships, about 400 men were locked into each crowded bunk room in cramped quarters with little ventilation. Although the troops were segregated from others in the ship, they still shared the same mess hall where they all ate. They would file through, breathing the same air and touching the same tables and chairs as the group before. On one ship, called the Leviathan, the flu broke out almost immediately, despite the quarantine efforts. Within 2 days, it had overwhelmed the ship's medical services. The doctors and nurses were laid up sick alongside their patients, delirious, coughing, and blood pouring from their bodies. The blood pooled on the floor, and the nurses, who were still well enough to work, walked through the puddles, leaving bloody footprints on the deck. Finally, there were so many sick men that they began laying them on the deck of the ship out in the elements. They even lay there in storms, because the well were too overwhelmed to move them, and the ill were too sick to move themselves. At first, the deaths came spaced apart, and the officers took careful notes in the captain's log of the Leviathan. At first, they wrote the date and time of death, the name and rank of the deceased, their unit, and cause of death. But only 1 week after leaving New York, the officers were so overwhelmed they wrote only name and time of death. The captain's log shows two deaths at 2 a.m., one at 2:02 a.m., two at 2:15 a.m. It continued like that around the clock. The healthy must have been terrified, locked onto a ship filled with a deadly plague with nowhere to escape. They began burying men at sea. At first, they were solemn ceremonies, but after so many, the funerals became routine. They would read a name, say a brief prayer, and slide the body off the boat, then on to the next. The same was happening in every boat carrying troops across the ocean. Medical advisors begged the military to stop the troop movements, but the war machine needed men. At the same time, it was infecting the civilian population from port to port and along the railway lines. However, the very worst outbreak probably occurred in Philadelphia, and it was made immeasurably worse by mismanagement by leaders who ignored warnings from public health doctors. Had public health measures been implemented, perhaps much of the death and suffering could have been avoided. Philadelphia in 1918 was teeming with people. Hundreds of thousands had swarmed the city because of the new job opportunities working at steel plants, docks, railroad yards, and industries that supplied the war. Without enough housing for the influx, poor people were crowded into squalid, filthy slums that lacked indoor plumbing. Multiple families would cram into one apartment and share an outhouse in an alleyway with hundreds of people. Sometimes people shared not only apartments but beds, even sleeping in shifts. The boarding houses would rent out beds for 6 or 8 hours at a time. When one worker woke up to go to work, another worker would get into the newly vacated bed and sleep, same sheets and all. The streets were notoriously filthy, with rat infestations and gutters filled with trash, animal, and even human feces. With people living in overcrowded conditions, exhausted from hard labor and weak from poor nutrition, dirty water, and bad air quality, it was a perfect breeding ground for an epidemic. I had a little bird. Its name was Enza. I opened the window, and influenza. Children's Jump Roping Song, 1918. A ship full of sick sailors arrived into the Philadelphia Navy Yard in mid-September. Within a few days, the Navy hospital was overrun, and the Navy began sending sailors to civilian hospitals in the city. As sailors began dying, the flu spread to civilians. 2 days after the first sailor arrived at the hospital, multiple doctors and nurses felt fine as they started their shifts, yet collapsed and became desperately ill within hours. However, the health board for the city didn't want people to panic. They downplayed the severity of the disease. After the death of several sailors and civilians, the health board confidently declared the disease had reached its zenith and already begun to decline. It hadn't even gotten started. At the same time, the federal government was desperate for money from war bonds to fund the war. People would buy bonds, essentially loaning the government money for a promise of being paid back later with interest. Every city had a quota of bonds they had to sell, and Philadelphia was ready to hold the Liberty Loan Parade to sell war bonds. Public health doctors begged the city to cancel the parade, terrified that it would cause the outbreak to become an epidemic. The city government ignored them. On September 28th, hundreds of thousands of people jammed into the downtown streets to watch the parade. In that huddled crowd, all crushed together, it only took a few coughing, sneezing people to launch the epidemic. Within 76 hours, just 3 days later, the city's 31 hospitals had run out of bed space. They were completely full. Some hospitals tried to cram in more by laying patients on cots in the hallways, in offices, and on balconies. In some cases, the sick were laid on the floor next to a dying patient. Once the patient died, the body was taken away and the new patient would be lifted into the same bed, still warm from the previous occupant. The city opened several temporary emergency hospitals, but it wasn't enough. Hospitals started refusing to accept any more patients. People lined up outside begging to be let in. Some died standing in line. Even for those who got in, care was non-existent for most people. The hospitals ran out of medicine. The doctors and nurses were overtaxed, and they were dropping from the flu. They were desperate for help. People with no medical training volunteered. Physicians and nurses came out of retirement. Medical schools closed, and first-year medical students were put in charge of an entire floor of a hospital. One medical student reported that during the height of the outbreak, one-fourth of all the patients in the hospital died every day. Nurses were so overtaxed, they began adding toe tags to the living so they could tag several at once. Once a patient turned blue, it was only a matter of hours to death, so they felt confident in tagging them. Sometimes there wasn't any time for any intervention. Some people died within 24 hours of contracting the flu. A nurse at Mount Sinai Hospital started her shift in the morning and suddenly fell ill. She died 12 hours after first feeling sick. The number of dead kept growing. 5 days after the city held the Liberty Lyon parade, city leaders finally acted. The health department banned all public meetings. Churches, schools, and theaters were closed. They left the bars open, but those too were closed the next day. The courts closed and city services shut down. It took only a few days for the city's operations to completely grind to a halt. Within just 10 days, Philadelphia went from a few hundred cases of flu and a couple deaths per day to hundreds of thousands of people sick and hundreds dying every day, all because they ignored public health guidelines. By 3 weeks after the parade, the death toll stood at 4,500. So many died that they couldn't be buried fast enough. Gravediggers were sick or refused to bury flu victims. The bodies started piling up inside morgues and funeral homes. Some undertakers raised their prices 500% to try and cash in. Most ran out of coffins. One funeral home that hadn't run out hired guards because people were trying to steal the coffins. People began wrapping their dead in blankets or sewing together flour sacks to use as shrouds. No one came to take the bodies, and there was nowhere to bring them, so the dead stayed in the homes. People wrapped them in blankets and set them in closed-off rooms. The bodies were laid on porches or stacked in back alleys. In the poor, overcrowded tenement houses where multiple families lived in one apartment, there were no porches or spare rooms to put the bodies. They set them in the corners or stacked them in the alleyways next to the shared outhouses and drinking water pumps. Sometimes, people were so sick that the person in bed next to them would die and they couldn't gather the strength to take the body away. The city began to smell, the stench of death hanging heavily in the air. Finally, families began digging their own graves to bury their dead. Everyone was terrified. People avoided each other. There were cases of children whose parents got sick, and the children starved because no one would go near them in case the child was sick. This was particularly a problem since those who were most likely to die were people aged between 20 to 40, many of them parents. People couldn't get food because no trucks were delivering goods in the city. The streets fell silent. Every business was closed. People hid inside their homes. The streetcars stopped. The police cars stopped. The entire city ceased to function. You were constantly afraid. You were afraid because you saw so much death around you, you were surrounded by death. When each day dawned, you didn't know whether you would be there when the sun set that day. It wiped out entire families from the time that the day began in the morning to bedtime at night. There wasn't any single soul left. William Sardo, Washington, D.C. The Philadelphia city government was by now non-functional. Wealthy Philadelphia families appealed to the federal government for help, but there was no help to send. Cities all across America were buckling beneath the weight of the epidemic, and the federal government was busy managing the outbreak on military bases and among troops in Europe. With the city government failing to act, the women of elite Philadelphia families, many of the same who had organized the Liberty Loan Parade, banded together to start outreach efforts. They gathered together civic leaders from across the city to start planning. They set up a special hotline to answer questions about the flu, but had a hard time keeping it staffed because so many employees were sick. They set up local neighborhood leaders who would organize distribution of food and medical care. They set up soup kitchens in the schools and food delivery to sick people when possible. 500 people volunteered their cars to be used as ambulances and to deliver food and drive doctors around to treat the sick. However, there was a desperate need for more volunteers, and most people were too afraid to get involved. Leaders begged for more help, but people turned away. The fabric of society began to break down. City leaders who hadn't bothered to attend meetings of the outreach effort finally got involved. They seized the city's emergency fund to pay for supplies and pay health workers. They opened additional morgues and sent out policemen to try and clear the piled up bodies. Like the ancient plagues, people carried their dead out to the streets. There, the bodies were loaded onto open trucks or horse-drawn wagons. There were no coffins, so they stacked them one on top of the other. Also, like in the days of the plague, they stopped trying to bury people individually and began digging mass graves where hundreds of bodies were dumped in. The city used construction equipment to dig long trenches and push the bodies in. Someone would stand by the trench, say a prayer, and then the steam shovels would push dirt over the piles of bodies. By late October, the epidemic was finally beginning to loosen its death grip on the city. In its aftermath, it left a death toll of 13,000. It also left thousands of orphaned children, a shortage of food and goods, and a stalled city that had to slowly grind its most basic services back into motion. Finally, it left a changed people, filled with fear, wearied by war and disease, and crushed by grief. The people of Phoenix are facing a crisis. Almost every home in the city has been stricken with the plague. Arizona Republican, November 8, 1918. In other cities and towns across America, the news was the same. In New York City, 33,000 people died before the statisticians stopped counting. Some small towns tried to keep the virus out by quarantining themselves. They shut down all businesses and canceled public gatherings. People were ordered to stay in their homes and not touch or visit others. Some towns made it illegal to shake hands. In other towns, police were dispatched to nail signs on the doors of homes where people were sick. The signs said, "Influenza," in red letters. Rumors spread in Phoenix, Arizona, that dogs spread the disease. Policemen killed dogs in the streets, and people killed their own pets. Towns in Colorado set up barricades on the roads, and men guarded them with shotguns, preventing anyone from coming in. Other towns couldn't stop the trains from rolling through on their local platforms, but they refused to let anyone step off the trains. Anyone who did was thrown in prison and quarantined. It didn't work. The virus still slipped in. The only place that escaped the worst of the rap was San Francisco, and historians credit that to aggressive response by the local government, who listened to their public health officials. Public Health Director William Hassler quarantined all naval stations before they had any reported cases. He knew it was only a matter of time. He ordered all public schools and gathering places closed. He divided the cities into separate districts with distinct support staff so as to segregate outbreaks. He laid out plans and organized the flu response before the flu ever hit the city so they would be ready when it did. The city's government, medical, and civic organizations banded together to educate citizens on prevention such as hand washing, avoiding public places, and wearing a face mask. While Philadelphia's government was still denying there was a problem, San Francisco authorities were distributing 100,000 face masks. Police enforced the face mask rule at gunpoint and actually shot people who refused to wear masks in the streets. As the second wave diminished throughout the country, San Francisco rejoiced for having missed the flu. The flu would mutate once more and rage through the world for a third time, but infecting and killing fewer people. This time it would be less severe. This time it did hit San Francisco because they thought the flu was already over. The third wave hit the Southwest and Midwest hard, but for the rest of America, the worst of the flu had passed. Even as America woke from the nightmare, the epidemic had left its imprint. Right at the height of harvest time, farmers had been too sick to farm, and workers didn't show up to gather the food in. Food that was harvested rotted in warehouses because there was no one to transport it. There was a lag while the country tried to catch up on shipping food and goods, and store shelves and markets stayed empty for some time because goods hadn't been delivered. As winter rolled in, there was a shortage of coal and other goods. However, the weary country still rejoiced, for an armistice was signed on November 11, 1918. The war was finally over, even as the plague and its effects lingered on. In the U.S., it killed about 675,000. The flu killed an estimated 3% of the entire world population. In Latin America, the flu killed 10 out of every 1,000 people. In Africa, about 15 out of every 1,000 died. And in parts of Asia, the death rate was as high as 35 per thousand. In Tahiti, it killed 10% of the population. And in Western Samoa, 20% of the population died. In India alone, it killed about 20 million people. You may be asking yourself, could a deadly flu like that happen again? It's important to understand that the Spanish flu was devastating for a number of reasons unique to that time. However, the essential formula for epidemics still exists. Viruses sometimes jump species, for instance, from pigs to human. This could happen at any time, anywhere in the world. And of course, flu viruses are constantly mutating. Usually mutations are minor, but occasionally a big mutation can happen. This has happened a few times in recent history. For instance, the Russian flu of 1889 killed about 1 million people. The Asian flu of 1957 killed about 2 million. And the Hong Kong flu of 1968 also killed about 2 million. Then in 2018, exactly 100 years after the outbreak of Spanish flu, a mutation brought a particularly deadly flu to the U.S. and Australia. As of 2018, there is one strain of avian flu, an H5 type, that has managed to infect humans, but so far cannot jump between people. However, that particular strain of flu is frightening in its potential, according to Donald Burke, MD, former director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Immunization Research. Of the people who have been affected, it has been deadly in over 75% of cases. If that type of flu adapted to human-to-human infection, it could be catastrophic. So could it happen again? Yes, it could. As Burke said, when it comes to the probability of a pandemic flu, I think everyone would say it's not if, it's when. However, there's reason to be hopeful. When a new kind of flu emerged in 2009, a swine flu, just like the Spanish flu, officials did not waste any time acting. Public health officials acted swiftly, putting emergency epidemic plans into operation. We were lucky that the 2009 swine flu, though very contagious, was not a deadly strain, and it showed us that response matters a great deal. In fact, the way we respond to the next big epidemic could mean the difference between life or death. If you enjoyed this video, please click like and subscribe to Education World for more videos.
It is no longer a question of if or when. Or can. It did. And we have failed in our response to protect ourselves. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Leaving you as I came before you with the hope and prayer that I have said nothing, done nothing to upset you, other than to educate you and prepare you. The most things you need to do, should do, and are. With that, good night, and while one, I will be with you next Tuesday from 6:30 a.m. Leaving you as I always do in the immortal words of the great black teacher, Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., and Adam Stephen, and the first church in the world. Keep the faith. Keep the faith.